So these last few weeks, I have been speaking about the topic of the five spiritual faculties of faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And these five come as a core element to a list called the 37 Requisites for Enlightenment. And that particular group of 37 is sort of an alternative approach to the core teachings of the Buddhist path. The other approach being Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path. So you can approach from the notion of what are the core teachings, or you can approach from the notion of what are the core requisites for accomplishing the goal. And the heart of those 37, this list comes of the five spiritual faculties, the five spiritual powers, the five precious jewels, faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And I've been suggesting to you over the recent weeks that you experiment with actually considering them as faculties, much like our faculties of seeing, hearing, touching, tasting, smelling, and thinking. And that they are faculties that we are born with, but like a small baby, not born with them trained at all. And that particularly in our culture, those five don't start to get trained nearly as early as the five senses, seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling. But that at any time we can begin to intentionally experience and cultivate them more. And then, in fact, they're really the heart of any spiritual path. You'll find these, maybe they have different names, slightly different names, but the cultivation of these spiritual faculties, spiritual powers. And then at the heart of them is mindfulness. And mindfulness helps us balance them all because they need to operate in balance, much like when we look at the hand, we have five appendages. But really, for so much of what we do, they all have to work together. They're individual, but there's not a lot. We can do some things with one or two of them, but they really work in concert. And so too the five spiritual powers. And that they also need to balance, and that they can get out of balance in various ways. We spoke of some of those ways last week. And that mindfulness is the factor at the heart of these, that allows us to balance the others and to know that we're balancing the others, to know when they're out of balance. And I read each week this lovely paragraph, and I'll read it again of all the, there are various paragraphs written, but I found that Joseph Goldstein's in Seeking the Heart of Wisdom is really a nice summarizing paragraph for these five faculties. The five spiritual faculties, faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, are our greatest friends and allies on this journey of understanding. These qualities are most powerful when they are in balance. Faith needs to be balanced with wisdom so that faith is not blind and wisdom is not shallow or hypocritical. When wisdom outstrips faith, we can develop a pattern where we know something and even know it deeply from our own experience, yet do not live it. Faith brings the quality of commitment to our understanding. Energy needs to be balanced with concentration. Effort will bring lucidity, clarity, and energy to the mind, which concentration balances with calmness and depth. An unbalanced effort makes us restless and scattered. And too much concentration that is not energized comes close to torpor and sleep. Mindfulness is the factor that balances all these and is therefore always beneficial. So tonight is a bit of a celebration of mindfulness, since it is always beneficial, and since indeed a lot of our path of practice is intentionally cultivating this factor of mind called mindfulness in our meditation practice and in other reflections. So before I get further into it, I did want to give you some good resources if you want, if you haven't looked at resources on the factor of sati, is the Pali word mindfulness. There's a couple of really fine pieces of work. Bhante Gunaratana, Ajahn Gunaratana, wrote this classic, Mindfulness in Plain English, many years ago. There's a newer version of it. So that says it all, Mindfulness in Plain English. It's very, very good, very, very clearly written. And particularly chapter 13 is called Sati. So if you don't want to read the whole book, you can just skip to chapter 13. You can also usually find it somewhere on the net. Its address tends to change, but it's written by a monastic, so it's freely offered on the net somewhere. So you could track it down that way too. Chapter 13 particularly. Excellent, excellent beginning. And then another item that, if you don't know, many of you may know these exist already, but last year, Joseph Goldstein published a 2-volume set of CDs called, this one is Abiding in Mindfulness, Volume 1. There's several CDs in it. Volume 2, Abiding in Mindfulness, Volume 2. Same cover, different color, same design. Blue, I think. And these are a large number of talks that he gave on the Satipatthana Sutta. He gave them at IMS and at the Forest Refuge and at the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies over a period of time, a couple of years at least, I think. And they were all recorded and put together in these collections. And if you like Joseph Goldstein's way of teaching, they're pretty amazing. So you might want to get those for auditory learning. So those are two. They're, pardon?
Do you repeat that by what they're called?
Repeat what they're called? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Abiding in Mindfulness, Volume 1 and 2. Thanks for asking. And I should have said that they're published by Sounds True. So you can go to soundstrue.com, or many of you may get their catalogs in the mail much more frequently than you would like. So there are ways to track them down. They're also a fundraiser, I believe, for the Forest Refuge, which is kind of neat as well. Very, very good material for those who have heard them. Just excellent stuff. So those are two of many resources on if you want to study, focus right in on what mindfulness is, sati, clear knowing. So in general, we can say that the word sati, translated as mindfulness, has two broader categories of meaning. And that is, one, its meaning with respect to the notion, the experience of remembering, the practice of recollection. So sometimes somebody would actually translate the word sati as remembering. And then there are actually a grouping of formal practices called recollections that have particular topics associated with them. And this is when we're thinking of mindfulness as mindfulness practice in the Buddhist tradition. So we would say mindfulness that leads us onward. Or if we're jump over to the list, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, right view and right mindfulness have to do with the kinds of focusing of mindfulness on, in this case, the recollections, or the other category would be the practices that lead us onward toward, on the path toward enlightenment, toward nibbana, toward freedom from suffering, toward the heart's release. So that would be the direction, the kind of mindfulness that we want to cultivate. And so there are recollections. There are a traditional grouping of recollections. And this is the official list. Reflections that recollect the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Reflections that recollect one's own ethical conduct and generosity. I'll comment on these a little bit, I'll go back. But recollecting the qualities of Buddhas and Devas, holy beings, angels, angelic beings. Recollecting past lives. I'll say something about that in a minute as well. So we go back and talk about reflections, recollections on the qualities of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So this could be a large number of different reflections. The focus is really bringing mindfulness, awareness, clear seeing to what those three actually are. What is a Buddha? What is the Dharma? What is the Sangha? How fortunate that we live in a time when the teachings of a Buddha and the memory of a Buddha, a living Buddha, are still alive and vital. How fortunate we are that we have spiritual friends and the Sangha of spiritual friends, the Sangha of those who also have walked quite far along the path so they can leave us little pink ribbons tied on the trees, cross-country skiing, where's the trail? You know, how fortunate we are that we have those who have accomplished a lot of freedom from suffering so they can tell us it is possible. It's not just a dream. It is possible because our practice takes a lot of effort and a lot of time. We get gray hair on the path. In the Tibetan tradition, it's interesting, they have a group of practices, the 400 or 500,000 preliminary practices. And you might have heard, you know, people talking about the 100,000 prostrations, which is the beginning of that. I'm actually working on those, oddly, having been in Buddhist practice for 40-some years, but not in that particular tradition, so I'm sort of just coming around to the preliminaries. So that may either be daunting or comforting to you all. We can all just begin again at any time. But because I'm old, I can't really do the full prostrations of the young. But looking at what that practice is, it involves actually the... You can use a picture, a tanka, fabric picture, or a photograph in front of you. And generally what that is you have a picture of what's called a refuge tree. And depending on the lineage that you're practicing in, the characters on that tree will be slightly different. But there will always be the historical Buddha surrounded by other Buddhas. There will be bodhisattvas. And then there will be great teachers of your particular lineage and the lineage of Buddhism in general. There'll be the arhats. There will be protectors of the Dharma. So it's basically a tree of... Oh, and also behind the main figure, whoever the main figure is, depending on your lineage, there will be pictures of all the books. They're Tibetan style, so sometimes when you look at these pictures, you don't recognize them as books, because Tibetan books are long and narrow, and they're filed sideways, so they just have like white and red kind of cloth tabs on them. So when you see a picture of a bookcase, a Tibetan bookcase, it may not register to you that those are books. The Dharma books are behind the central figure. So it's a picture of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, the refuge tree. And so while you're doing your regular prostration, or what I like to call my old lady prostrations, but whatever the practice physically and the verses that you're saying, the refuge verses, there is also the recollection of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And one can work with visualization of that. But the main feeling, the juice of it, as my teacher likes to say, the juiciness, is to feel that there is a powerful, powerful path of practice that has been passed down through these beings. Some of them are historical. You can track your lineage in hundreds of years. Others are the vaster expanses of time. Shakyamuni Buddha is there, but also other great Buddhas of other millennia. That this teaching has been passed down one by one, teacher to student, to you. There you are, receiving that teaching in an unbroken lineage. And if it weren't for those people and beings, you wouldn't be receiving this teaching. So that's why one bows, and if one can, one just goes all the way down, because it feels like such a miracle, and one is so grateful that these teachings, and particularly as you move along in the path, you see, you understand what your life would have been like without them, and what your life is without this path. And so you bring mindfulness to that recollection, and you begin to see that it's golden. It's made of gold. And so the meditations and the recollection on the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, bringing us more and more mindfulness, more and more awareness of just what it is we're doing and how fortunate we are. Particularly with before I went on retreat, there was so much distress in Burma, one of the old countries of Buddhism. And now, of course, there's so much suffering in Tibet, another of the old countries of Buddhism, that it's very hard for us. It makes our heart ache. But it can also serve as this sort of recollection to be really aware of how fortunate we are. They can't practice anymore in the old country. When the Tibetans fled and went to India, to them, they were going to the Holy Land, because for them, that's where Buddhism, well, for us too, that's where Buddhism came from. So, and it was amazing, because over centuries, there had been less and less Buddhism practiced in India. The most Buddhism practiced in India, the most Buddhists in India are Tibetan Buddhists. So history is very unusual, and the changes and so forth. Vietnamese Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh had to flee his home country, carried Vietnamese Zen in exile with him, and only in the recent years has been allowed to return and teach Buddhism to the Vietnamese, who during that time had very little opportunity to practice. So the vicissitudes of history and the changes are sometimes quite dramatically seen, and that we can bring mindfulness, reflect, recollect the value of this practice and how fortunate we are to have these teachings. Recollecting one's own ethical conduct and generosity. This seems particularly odd to us more self-critical modern people. We will have a tendency to reflect on all of our shortcomings and make lists of them and chastise ourselves. And yet, both with mindfulness and for the increase of mindfulness as a mental factor, reflecting on our good qualities, our own ethical conduct, really strengthens mindfulness. Part of it is it strengthens our sense of possibility, that we can do this, that we can change, that we can change in ways that are valuable to us and to others. And that reflecting on that lightens our heart, it lifts our heart, it gives us the ability to continue with our practice, so why not? Interesting. Recollecting on the qualities of the Buddha and the Buddhas and Devas. Although at first this may seem a little bit odd, and in the monastic traditions one has, and in the scriptures you can have lists of the qualities of a Buddha, that may seem at first a little bit odd to us. But actually in our culture and over historical time we see this happening all the time in terms of reflecting on the qualities of holy beings, angels and saints, saints and sages, all the stories that come down to us through spiritual traditions, religious traditions, and also other ways, the reflections on the qualities of Gandhi. Really, just the stories of who Gandhi was and his life, what he taught. He's really one of the Dalai Lama's inspiring beings. Reflections on other saints and sages through the ages. We see Mother Teresa. We see Martin Luther King. We remember these people. They're no longer living, but we remember their qualities, and they give us inspiration. They tell us of the possibilities, so we keep recollecting them so that we can remember. So we include the qualities of the Buddhas, angels, saints, and sages in our recollection, strengthening our commitment, strengthening our mindfulness by mindfully remembering, giving us a kind of a goal, giving us values, particularly in the stormy sea, that it's getting pretty stormy. The 20th century was something, but we lights emerged also, so we recollect those. And then down through history, what history we have, recollection and remembering the holy beings for inspiration. Recollecting past lives. Now, many in the West, that's an aspect of the Buddhist practice that they either just can't even consider, or when considered, have not had that experience in their own practice. But we have quite a bit of access to history. A lot more access to history than a lot of other times on the planet. So we don't have to, if we don't want to get technical, that it's our past life, we have both historical relatives, biological relatives, we have geographical history and so forth. So we do have access to many past lives to recollect, and particularly with respect to our practice as a mindfulness practice, what we want to see when we recollect history is cause and effect. We want to be able to see clearly suffering and the causes of suffering. As the famous quote, you know, who does not remember history is condemned to repeat it. That could be a Buddhist teaching, that that's the way it is, that without seeing clearly the nature of suffering, the causes that give rise to suffering, we have no hope of making change. We need to see the conditioned habitual patterns create suffering. And we don't have to go far in history. We can. We have people who can go pretty far back, but boy, all we need is the 20th century to see on a gigantic world scale how the mind when not taken care of, how the heart, when not opened to compassion, just turned loose, can create destruction in numbers on scales just almost beyond thinking. So we can reflect on, recollect on past lives if we think of that as a consideration of history and look at causes and conditions giving rise to suffering, and then see that and use it as a motivation for change in ourselves to motivate us along the path. And then the other kind of definition of sati, which has to do with clear seeing, clear knowing, wakefulness, non-interfering awareness, bare attention, those kinds of definitions we might be a little bit more familiar with, because that leads us to our meditation practices of cultivating mindfulness, using techniques of meditation to cultivate mindfulness as a factor of mind and a faculty that we can strengthen and see the awesome power of this factor of mind, this faculty. It's Joseph. Anyway, there's the German-born monk Nipponika Thera, who defined mindfulness in this way. Mindfulness is the clear and single-minded awareness of what actually happens to us and in us at the successive moments of perception. So that we begin to see that, oh, that's what we're doing in meditation practices. There's successive moments of perception. We're training ourselves to see what happens in those successive moments of perception. It attends just to the bare facts of a perception as presented either through the five physical senses or through the mind, without reacting to them by deed, speech, or by mental comment, which may be one of self-reference, like liking or disliking, or without judgment or reflection. Okay, so I wanted to emphasize in these talks, I have been emphasizing what this stuff all means just right down in our life practice, which is why I gave some examples of looking at history and so forth. So here we are now with a definition of mindfulness and practicing mindfulness and what mindfulness does. It attends to just the bare facts of a perception as presented, either through the five physical senses or through the mind, without reacting to them by deed, by speech, or by mental comment. So how do we do that? because we know that pretty much our experience of life is experience seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, mental formations inside our heads or coming out of other people's mouths, and reacting to them by liking, by disliking, by judging, oh, lots of judging, by self-reference, ah, that's mine, oh, that, I want that. You know, I'll be really happy if I get that. So, by reflection, just rumination, endless rumination. Well, a moment of mindfulness actually is that. And so what we need to do is cultivate, find out what mindfulness is, and then cultivate it. So how do we do that? What we see is that there can be a moment of mindfulness. So my example, many of you are familiar, is always to say, right now, become mindful of seeing. So you've been looking at me this whole time, but now, when I say be mindful of seeing, something extra is added. So that's how you can feel, that's mindfulness. Sometimes it's mindfulness/awareness. There's some way where mindfulness is being discussed, and there's a separation of mindfulness and awareness into two different factors. And then sometimes, particularly when Bhante Ji is talking about what mindfulness is, he's talking about mindfulness with a capital M. It's mindfulness, awareness together. But we can experience that. But then what happens is it drifts away. Now, are we still mindful of seeing? Or did it drift away as I continue to talk? Bring mindfulness to hearing now. Again, I've been talking, we've been hearing all night, and yet when we bring mindfulness to it, something extra is there. So mindfulness of hearing. Now, did mindfulness of seeing fall away? You're still looking at me, but did mindfulness of seeing fall away when I talked about mindfulness of hearing? It does, doesn't it? So that's what naturally happens. We bring up mindfulness, and then it falls away on its own. And we see that, and we bring up mindfulness again. And that's our practice. When we're doing our meditation practice, mindfulness of rising and falling and so forth. When the moment of mindfulness is there, there is not reactivity. But then as mindfulness starts to fall away, reactivity can arise. Or we usually see this down the line. We see there's been experience, we're reacting and so forth. But then we bring mindfulness in, and sometimes, particularly as we move along in our training, in our practice, we can lessen the reactivity. Mindfulness jumps in, reactivity falls away. There's a little gap where we can regain balance. We can regain some equanimity. And if we keep asserting, maybe applying, moving in the direction of mindfulness, the reactivity continues to fall away. This all happens very quickly. Someone last night in Olympia asked me if we can be mindful of more than one sensation in one moment. We can't really, but since there are 17 trillion mind moments in 1 second of human experience, it can seem that we can be mindful of several things at once. So technically, no, but yes, you can bring mindfulness to seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, thinking. Pretty much it'll seem, if you're getting it really strong, it'll seem like you can do it, or at least a couple of things. So we want to keep bringing and strengthening this factor of mindfulness, because it naturally, with its presence, allows, or the result is that the reactivity, the habits of reactivity are gone, even if it's just for that second. And then in the next second, we bring forth mindfulness again. So it's interesting, because sometimes as we go along in practice, we are learning to see habit patterns, conditioned habit patterns, painful ones, judgment. Oops, I'm judging again, you know, as though it's I, when it's really just this conditioned habit pattern that keeps re-arising. And we bring in a lot of mindfulness, and then we think we need to do something else. So how do I fix it? Become more non-judgmental. Things like that. But really, the answer is just more moments of mindfulness. Stick with it. And you will see judgment can't live in a moment of mindfulness. So the more of them you string together, the calmer we get. The more balance, the more equanimity there is. So don't worry so much when it falls away. No blame, no harm, no foul. Don't worry about it. When you see the mind wander, just bring back a moment of mindfulness. Actually, seeing it has wandered is already a moment of mindfulness. That's gold. That's the gold. So then, where do I go? Well, in our training as a beginning, we use breath sensations and body sensations as anchors, because we know how it feels. Mindfulness of breath sensations. Breath is always there. Mindfulness of pressure under the feet or the seat. Pressure is always there. Mindfulness of the pressure. Were you mindful of it before I mentioned it? The sensation is always there, but now mindfulness of that pressure sensation beneath the feet or the seat. There it is. So for when we're beginners, for the first 10 or 20 years, anchoring sensations in the body, really, really helpful. And then, now it's not that the sensations beneath the feet or the seat are in any way particularly holy, nor is the breath sensation holy, but it gives us something to be mindful of relatively neutral and in the present moment, and it's generally non-conceptual, although you'll see the mind start to think about it right away. Oh, there's a pulsing sensation. Oh, I'll bet that's the blood. Oh, that's funny. Now, do I have veins in my heels? It's really odd, but I can feel a tingling there, so maybe it's vein pulsing. Gee, I'll have to look into that, and then research, and the internet, and so forth. Mindfulness is gone. That's called papancha. Mindfulness can see this. Papancha is the tendency of the mind to proliferate endlessly when there's no mindfulness. We can think about anything, and we can think about it forever. I mean, it'll just proliferate, you know, and there'll be books, there will be volumes. But when we bring in mindfulness, we see that happening, then we let it go. Now, as you progress, one can be mindful of awareness itself, choiceless awareness, that's called. But for a long time, using some anchor, physical sensation, breath sensation, is really, really skillful. We can also be mindful of just the sense of now, nowness. So we can let go and return to nowness. Some people will do that. You know, you can do that a number of years. That refines it. Mindful of knowing. And then there's a further, when we're moving to mindfulness with a capital M, moving to mindfulness awareness to a capital M, for example, in the Dzogchen tradition in Tibetan Buddhism, where we go beyond any even remote connection with conceptualization of any kind. And there's no individual perceiving. There's no perceiver and perceived anymore. It's an awareness of mindfulness, awareness, capital. In the Tao Te Ching, they mention the Tao that can be spoken of is not the true Tao. Or we know Rumi, who says, out beyond ideas of wrongdoing or rightdoing, there's a field. I'll meet you there. So there's some place, if we had the Castaneda books, there was the Tonal and the Nahual. And the Nahual, well, you can't even speak of the Nahual. The Tonal is everything you can speak of and think of and everything that's in existence. And then there's the Nahual. So Dzogchen, it's Rigpa. There's a perception and awareness beyond thinking. Mindfulness is the trail. The mindfulness that we can work with, the way that we can perceive it and train, that's the trail. Bhante Gunaratana. So, of course, everybody calls him Bhante Ji, right? But it's just as it sounds if you're looking for it in books or on the net. Gunaratana. Gunaratana. Bhante Ji, I'd like to say a little about what he said. Chapter 13, you check it out. It's really fun. Mindfulness is the English translation of the Pali word sati. Sati is an activity. What exactly is that? There can be no precise answer, at least not in words. Words are devised by the symbolic levels of the mind, and they describe those realities with which symbolic thinking deals. Mindfulness is pre-symbolic. It is not shackled to logic. Nevertheless, mindfulness can be experienced rather easily. Be mindful of hearing right now. And it can be described as long as you keep in mind that the words are only fingers pointing at the moon. They are not the thing itself. The actual experience lies beyond the words and above the symbols. Mindfulness could be described in completely different terms than will be used here. He's talking about subsequent paragraphs. And each description still could be correct. So it's very awesome what he's doing. He's saying, okay, I'm going to be giving you some descriptions of mindfulness, but just think of them as fingers pointing at the moon, And then also realize that there, you could get another list of descriptions of mindfulness completely different from this one, and they could also be correct. So then he mentions mindfulness is a subtle process that you are using at this very moment. The fact that it is above and beyond words does not make it unreal. In fact, the reverse. Mindfulness is the reality that gives rise to words. The words that follow are simply the pale shadows of that reality. So we can, you know, if a lot of wonderful books have been published in recent years, the Tao Te Ching, the Tao that can be spoken of is not the true Tao. And then this beautiful pointing at. So when you first become aware of something, there is an instant, a fleeting instant of pure awareness before you name it. It's very short, it's a flash. And that's what mindfulness really is. That's where it is, that's what it is. And then the mind starts thinking. So that's why I often ask people to start, and so many teachers do, with mindfulness of hearing. You can notice when you do that how maybe there's just a moment and it's pure hearing. But then you notice your mind is starting to listen. It's trying to figure out what are the sounds. And then it will either start telling you words for the sounds or little pictures. You know, if we're by the freeway meditating, little pictures of cars will start popping in the mind. Or, you know, in the house, it's always refrigerator, huh? You know, so, but right before that, you just have this pure awareness of hearing as a sensation. Or when there are sounds that the mind can't identify, that's kind of nice, because then you can really get that flavor of just awareness of hearing sensation. Seeing, tasting, touching, smelling, thinking. We're practicing seeing the mind start to think about that, letting that go. All of this we're using mindfulness to see what's happening, to see what fell away, to see clearly, and then bring attention back to breath sensations, body sensations. Eventually we get to mindfulness without any particular object, objectless awareness. We get to a sense of nowness, a sense of knowingness, and then we get to another kind of awareness, that the word now is too conceptual. The word knowing, too conceptual. It's awareness. I can't say it. There's not a word. But it's a kind. And we work our way, we train our way to have that experience. And then, of course, it keeps eroding. We recognize it, it erodes. That's just what happens. But we become more and more familiar with it. But our mindfulness practice, our basic technique of practice, is the road. The yellow brick road made of golden bricks. Really. Really. And gold is getting worth a lot these days. But the bricks of mindfulness are worth more. Mindfulness is mirror thought. It's another description, Bhante-ji. Mirror thought. You know, when you go in front of a mirror, when you put a mirror up here, it's going to reflect everything exactly as it is. There will be no editing. There will be no reacting. There will be no commentary. The mirror just reflects. That's what mindfulness does. Then our conditioned habit patterns of liking and disliking arise in the next moment. And we experience the habit of reaction. But mindfulness sees what's there, mirror thought. There's no bias. So any moment of mindfulness is a moment free of that conditioned habit pattern of bias. It's a moment free of self and selfing. It's non-judgmental. It's tremendously healing. And the healing power of mindfulness, particularly now, the end of the 20th and in the 21st century, all of the research done with working with mindfulness-based therapies for stress reduction, for psychological healing, there's a tremendous amount going on now, and it's only going to increase. To see this power, even when it's not particularly related to a spiritual practice, cultivating, teaching people to cultivate mindfulness is helping them heal in amazing ways. And now they're tracking it. They're seeing, you know, in the brain scans that see the neuroplasticity of the brain, not only can mindfulness help you heal old, habitually conditioned psychological patterns that are very painful, it will also change the structure of your brain while you do it, so that parts of the brain will be enlivened. Other parts that have been too active, like people with OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, the parts of the brain that are miswired and they're way too active, they now see after training in mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, the overactivity of those parts of the brain is lessened. The brain's energy is healing and rebalancing itself. So what I guess the main thing that I want to convey is that the training that we do, the time that we spend in mindfulness practice, the time you spend, is just so powerful, so rich, so healing. There's never have any regret for any moments of mindfulness practice. Don't worry even when you sit down to practice and you're sleepy, so you feel like, well, you know, maybe that session there were 12. It doesn't matter, because they are onward leading. Mindfulness leads to more mindfulness. So they will be as seeds planted in the mind stream. They are as though the mind stream is like a light, like if we had this light covered completely with like say a black shade, and maybe we took long needles, say like acupuncture needles, thin, sharp, and every moment of mindfulness is piercing that. Eventually the light's going to shine through, because even though it's a thin needle, we just keep going, keep going, keep going, and each time we do it, more light shines through. The light of our Buddha nature, enlightenment, the light of awareness, which is always shining, is only covered by the darkness of conditioned habit patterns, non-mindfulness moments. And we see what the world is like without mindfulness. We see that it hasn't worked. So to any being that works with practicing, you are doing work both for yourself individually, your individual mind stream, but also for the sake of all beings. There's more light on the planet. Every moment that you use in practice and make effort, you're bringing more light to this planet and to all sentient beings. So it's just the best thing that you can do with your time. And so that really, the message that I'd like to convey is that there is no bad here. Any moment of mindfulness is always beneficial. It changes the causes and conditions in your mind stream. It always changes them for the better. It is just such a unique factor of mind. That's why it's on all the lists. Whatever of the lists in Buddhism, there is mindfulness there. This wonderful verse about mindfulness that by Nyosho Ken Rinpoche, Joseph Goldstein, Dean called it an ode to mindfulness I'd like to share for you. Mindfulness is the root of Dharma. Mindfulness is the body of practice. Mindfulness is the fortress of the mind. Mindfulness is the aid to wisdom of innate wakefulness. Lack of mindfulness will allow the negative forces to overcome you. Without mindfulness, you will be swept away by laziness. Lack of mindfulness is the creator of evil deeds. Without mindfulness and presence of mind, nothing can be accomplished. Without mindfulness, you are a heartless zombie, a walking corpse. Dear Dharma friends, please be mindful. By the aspiration of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, may all Dharma friends attain stable mindfulness and ascend the throne of perfect awakening. So I'll leave you with that because I've run out of time, and then ask if you'd like, since we've been chanting the last 4 weeks, would you like to chant the refuges with me in Pali, those of you who know them, as a nice ending to our time together. Buddham saranam gacchami, Dhammam saranam gacchami, Sangham saranam gacchami, Dutiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami, Dutiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami, Dutiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami, Tatiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami, Tatiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami, Tatiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami.